Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you from all over the world. If you'd like to watch today's program, just go to the Ustream channel and search for Gary Null. We have a lot of people listening over the telephone, and if you should miss a program or part of it, not to worry, you can catch it on the archives. In fact, you can listen over your computer, or you can listen by telephone. I'll give you those numbers. To listen to any downloaded show, for example, last night, I did an unusual progressive commentary hour. Normally, it's on a really heavy topic, single topic, single guest. But instead, I wanted to show you the background of those individuals who are either being considered for an important cabinet position in the Trump administration or will be in his office or on the phone regularly as a consultant to him, one of his advisors. The advisors and consultants require no screening. There's no approval process. But what if they're very powerful and influential? Wouldn't you want to know who they are? So we went through them. And once you saw, all of these are corporatists. All of these, they are the world globalists, the neoliberalists, and most of them are neo-fascist. And they have really draconian, backward views. Just completely insensitive to the needs of this time. So at least now you will know, and on a regular daily basis, anyone that we see is having any input in our government, we're going to give you their background so you'll know who they are. And now you can download that or any other show. I'll give you the phone number, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976, or Monday to Friday, noon to 1, every day. You can listen live by any portable listening device. It's 701-801-3662, 701-801-3662. I've got a wonderful guest in the second part of our program. I always enjoy having him on because he is just one of those unique minds. He is a scholar. He was, I believe, the youngest professor in Oxford University's history. He is Dr. Andrew Harvey. He's an internationally renowned religious scholar. He is the author of over 30 books. He's the founder of the Institute of Sacred Activism, and he is also taught at Oxford and Cornell University and a lot of other places. We're going to talk about our entrance into the age of folly. How do we prepare ourselves for anything in life? Now, in that light, I also believe that one of the greatest groups of people that we can embrace and nurture, and we're needed guide, are the millennials. And to get them, because a lot of them have not yet solidified their full beliefs. So what if we got them interested in environmental issues or health issues or multiple party issues? Think of the 40 to 50 million of them that could help with the cause that's needed. So I'm going to play you an audio clip from Simon Sinek. Very insightful. And a little parody on the millennials. It's just fun. And then a clip from the 1950s from Jack Webb of Dragnet television series that would be just timely today also. So we have a lot to share. But we always start with health and healing. And I'll be giving a short commentary from Professor Cornel West, Goodbye America, Neoliberalism, A New Neo-Fascist Era Is Here, and from Chris Hedges, We're All Deplorable, from Truth Dig. I was just studying this morning the latest research, because I always like to keep up every single day. One of the things I do when I'm up early in the morning is I read. And I'm always surprised when I found a new use for an old herb. And the herb today is ashwagandha. Ashwag, ananda, ashwagandha. Now, what it is, it's showing anti-aging effects. And this was published through a university. And here's what it says, quote, extracts from the ashwagandha root may significantly increase telomerase activity, thereby protecting against telomere loss and potentially delaying aging. Well, that's terrific. Why? It's relatively simple. Anything that you do, like meditation, laughing, creating a lot of good energy, stimulating our natural hormone levels, the excito levels that inspire us to find joy in life, all these things extend our lifespan because they extend the life of the telomere. Now, the telomere is the end of a chromosome, but the other side is also true. If you drink or do drugs, many medications, almost all of the American diet as it is currently consumed, high fat, high processed carbohydrates, high meat, soft drinks, sodas, coffee, all of these shorten the telomeres, the impactin enzyme telomerase, and that means you live a shorter life. Now, this is nothing theoretical to me. It's not existential. It's real. Because for over 33 years as a research scholar and fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology and Anti-Aging Medicine, I had a chance to see firsthand, this is aside from my clinical practice, I had a chance to see firsthand with animals that I would rescue from the labs where they were doing chemotherapy work, and I would give them beautiful music, no cages whatsoever, fun in hiding foods that have to, you know, look in different places, and giving them food that was organic and juices that I'd make fresh each day. These wonderful creatures that never once in all those decades bit me, not one time, they would frequently live anywhere from 30, and the longest group I had was over 70% longer than normal lifespan, but without cannibalism, which was common, and without obesity, and without different infections in the joints, which were also common when they're kept in a little cage and given standard rat chow. So I was studying the telomeres, and that's how I came to see that a lot of people are not happy. If you're not happy, you're stressed. If you're stressed, cortisol shortens telomeres. So unhappy people live shorter lives. Happier people can live longer lives. So this study is showing that the aging and lifespan of normal, healthy cells are linked to the so-called telomerase shortening mechanisms, which limit cells to a fixed number of divisions. During cell replication, the telomeres function by ensuring the cell's chromosomes do not fuse with each other or rearrange, which can lead to cancer. And the telomerase in question was researched and found, wow, this one herb, ashwagandha, it can extend it. And this was published in the Advances in Bioscience and Biotechnology. So, good news. Add that to your anti-aging NAD, L-carnosine, resveratrol, and pycnogenol. Those all extend your life. Also, tomato extract shows blood-thinning potential versus aspirin. This is a good thing because I'm opposed to using aspirin unless you had no other choice. Yes, then you do. Just some people are confused. They think I would never support any use of drugs. That's not true. If there's no other option or if a drug does what nothing else will do, then of course you use the drug for the period of time necessary and then wean yourself off when your body improves and you rebalance yourself. And I never tell people, ever, don't take that drug. What I do is ask them to work with their physician so as their body begins to change and they get healthier and their biochemistry improves, then the body does not require that drug, like insulin for type 2 diabetes. Virtually everyone I've ever worked with was able to go off, but they didn't do it. Their doctor showed, hey, doc, my fasting blood sugar is 75. It was 185. And now it's this. Doctor says, well, okay, as long as you're checking it, then you don't need the insulin. Same way with blood pressure-lowering medications. Because there's always a side effect to every medication. And if that's a negative side effect, you don't want it. For example, if you have irregular heartbeat, AFib, or tachycardia, and they say, take this medication, the side effect could be, yes, it can thin the blood, but about 24,000 people minimally die each year from bleeding from the medication, generally aspirin. But if you were to thin the blood with having green juices, eating green vegetables like celery and salads, taking vitamin C will thin the blood better than aspirin and stays longer in the blood. Vitamin E is even better than vitamin C. Why not thin the blood without the side effects? So there's this great divide between what good science supports and orthodox medicine practices. I don't want you to be the victim. Give you an example. This is from the University of Aberdeen, which is in Scotland, and this was published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Here's what it says, quote, this tomato extract, backed by European Union health claim law, is benefiting blood circulation. It has been shown to thin the blood in healthy people and without side effects and less severely than aspirin. And this was all based upon platelet function, and it keeps your platelets segregated and separated, and it doesn't allow that clumping, and it's the clumping that's important. And this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study, a crossover experiment. So let's start looking at tomatoes. Tomato juice would be a good place to start. Also, another study talked about quercetin. I had my first experience with quercetin when I was visiting a Dr. Girolo, who was the head biochemist at the the Linus Pauling Institute in California. And he was showing me what he thought was just a remarkable new experiment. He was using quercetin, the same quercetin I advocate all the time, to kill AIDS cells, and the viruses were being destroyed. So I watched this. And I said, you know, there are those of us who are using vitamin C in very high doses. At that time at the Institute, at the Tri-State Healing Center, I was using between 100 to 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C plus aqua vitamin A plus glutathione pushes and quercetin. And I was giving 10,000 milligrams quercetin a day to people who had AIDS-defining illnesses, and I was working with 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS. And we wanted to have a kill-off of the viruses. Not just HIV, but hepatitis, human herpes 6. There are a whole scat of viruses that I believe are contributing to a person's immune defects. And I said the doctor in California is Dr. Robert Cathcart. Now, Cathcart was an orthodox physician who was motivated to start using 50,000 milligrams of intravenous vitamin C on his patients suffering from Kaposi sarcoma and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, the top killers of persons with AIDS. And he was able to stop it in his tracks. I brought him into New York. I had a conference for him and 14 other physicians from around the world. There was doctors in China and Japan using herbs. We brought them in. So if there was anyone helping AIDS with natural therapies, with a good scientific background, we'd bring them in, and we did a whole symposium, a photograph of those people, some of them, in that symposium. And I know a lot of you listening were there because we had about 1,700 people that day in this big church over on Center Park West. But they all had something in common: natural treatments to build up the immune system and natural antivirals. One of the scientists talked about the natural antiviral. Now, mind you, it's not just antiviral HIV. It was antiviral herpes, antiviral cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, hepatitis virus, with, for example, bitter melon. So every single person who came in got bitter melon juice. They could drink as much as they wanted, and we had phenomenal results. There was a person that I knew named Stokely Carmichael, and one of the voices of the African-American community. There was also another person who came in on a regular basis, Arthur Ashe. And Arthur would sit there night after night. I'd go by out of my office and go down to the drip room, and there would be like 25 people getting drips, and Arthur would be sitting talking with people. And the doctors, the medical doctors on staff, he'd say, can I look at this person's patient's records? Well, of course, with patient's permission, yes. And he'd say, well, how in the world is this possible? How'd you go from this viral load to this viral load? And they'd say, well, we just cleaned up our lifestyle and diet, and we're getting all these antivirals. And they'd have a whole list of antivirals. Right at the top of that was quercetin. I believe, I'm not sure whether it was Stokely Carmichael or whether it was Arthur Ashe, but one of them contacted someone in PBS's Tony Brown's Journal's office and got a call from Tony Brown, and Tony says, here you're getting good results with people with AIDS over there. I said, we're getting okay results. He says, can I send someone over and take a look? I said, sure. So some people came by, and they talk with patients, and then they look at the medical records, and they said, we have one of our medical doctors verify all this. Said, fine, go ahead. We're open to the world. Nothing hidden here. Come in. We want people to come in. Nurses, doctors, we want people to come see what's being done with a natural, non-toxic approach. And boy, did we catch flack for that. Oh, wow. Wow. Because remember, on the one hand, we're the only place on the planet that was reversing age completely using natural techniques. We didn't tell anyone to stop your drugs. But on the other hand, imagine what kind of threat that is to the AZT people, to the big pharma people, and the AIDS groups that were getting their money from them. And so they didn't like us at all. They did everything they could, AIDS denialists and all this other nonsense, just to try to keep people from looking to see what we were doing. But we were doing good. And if they were doing good, good for them. But we were doing real good. In any case, we had a press conference, but no one came. We held all-day seminars, but people did come, but not the media. But Tony Brown came. And then over a period of several years, he would invite people who had completely reversed their AIDS onto his air. And by the way, that was 400 stations around America on PBS carried these. I was on. The people went on. You can still see these up on YouTube. And the African-American community got wind of this. And it Amsterdam News, Bill Tatum came down. Everybody wanted to know about this. So here you had this phenomena. I realize I got a little sidetracked, but I just want you to see where this goes. The African-American community became the most educated community in the United States in its history of how to deal with AIDS-defining illnesses. And yet, walk across the street to a regular doctor's office, and you just see them putting on the white gloves and the mask and everything so that they wouldn't get infected. You can't get infected with AIDS through the air. That's insane. Anyhow, and they just wouldn't be open to this. The drugs, yes, even if every patient died. In fact, one guy came in from California, tall guy. I'm going to guess he was around 6'8", 6'9". He was huge. And he walks in one day, and he said, am I in the right place? He said, is this where they help people with AIDS? I said, yeah, you're in the right place. I was in the hallway at the time. And he said, what do you got to do? And I said, well, you just show up, see one of the doctors, and we have a whole team of medical doctors here. See the doctor, and we'll get you in the program. He said, well, I don't have any money. I spent it all. I said, it's okay. It's okay. We don't turn anyone away. This is not about making money here. As he would see, I paid for all those people's treatment myself. And I said, why are you here? He said, well, because every single one of the people in all my AIDS support groups in California in the last 2 to 3 years, they're all dead. How many? Over 2,000. He said, and it got to the point where they didn't want me to talk because I was talking about, you know, going down and get my wheatgrass juice and healthy diet. And no, they had guys in there every single day at every single meeting talking about take drugs, take drugs, take drugs. And he said he got in arguments with them because he said, well, if these drugs are working, why is everyone dying? And they just went after him. He said he just couldn't take the anger and the hostility. These were from the so-called AIDS support systems that supported the pharmaceutical approach. I said, well, here you won't find that. Here you'll find people with open minds, open hearts, and a room full of people who all have their stories of their journey. And these people are not dying. They're living. And he stayed and completely and vitally healthy within 13 months. Anyhow, you wouldn't know any of that existed at all. But it did. And it's too bad that the American media was so biased and the left was so prejudiced that it would only support those radicalized voices who would align with Big Pharma, ideologically, politically, or financially, instead of looking for the truth, because the truth was there. But the African-American community was the only community willing to hear that truth. Good for you. Now back to the Southern Medical Institute. Quote, quercetin found to offer natural protection against influenza virus. How about this? I'll quote this. With the flu season upon us, health authorities are urging Americans to receive their annual flu shot. A vaccine is loaded with neurotoxins and very possibly completely ineffective. Not surprisingly, many are saying thanks but no thanks to the shot, choosing to rely instead on a healthy lifestyle and natural immune boosters to avoid the flu. Now it looks like they may have a powerful new ally in quercetin. By the way, quercetin is Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, quercetin. It's a potent flavonoid and phytonutrient found in many healthy foods and online. New research reveals a great reason to consume quercetin. A group of Chinese scientists released a study showing that quercetin can actually block the flu virus from entering cells, which the virus needs to do in order to live and replicate. The team conducted the study by adding quercetin to cells prior to infecting them with influenza and found that the quercetin-treated cells had significantly lower rates of infection than the cells that had not been treated, an obvious inhibitory effect. Quercetin was found to be effective against influenza A, as well as a subtype H1N1, H3N1. It was also found to work against H5N1, an avian flu, a particularly dangerous subtype with a 60% mortality rate. Researchers characterized quercetin as having the potential to be a safe, effective, and affordable treatment for influenza A viruses. And then it goes into how it actually works. So, think of this. 1988, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, etc. We were using quercetin against all kinds of viruses, from the HIV virus clear through and killing them. At the Linus Pauling Institute, Dr. Jwala was killing the HIV virus with quercetin. You wouldn't know any of that, would you? From the mainstream or alternative media, not a word. But it's real, so that's information that can help you. When I have time on an upcoming show, I'd like to share a few personal little observations, including a lecture I did out in California. And it was a nice group, packed house, but right in the front row, because I don't like to stand on a stage. I like to get down off the stage. I never stand behind a podium. I like to walk around, look at people eye to eye. And it was while I was down there, I was looking Smokey Robinson, Isaac Kennedy, Phyllis George, all these people right in the who knew how many people, celebrities, were really into health and wanting to change their lives. But there are a lot and growing now, and that's good, especially in the vegan movement, the vegetarian movement. I'm concerned about the idea that we should use the political forms, the bully pulpits, to condemn large numbers of people without knowing those people. Now, you may be able to have one-on-one conversations and like or dislike what someone says. You can agree or disagree. But to take 30 million people in the United States and just backhand them into a septic system by calling them deplorables, not such a good idea. A little tone deaf, I guess, when you have so much power and you're accepted without any challenge by a lot of acolytes, then you can get away with it. My relatives in Maine are deplorables, according to Chris Hedges. I cannot write on their behalf. I can write in their defense. They live in towns and villages that have been ravaged by deindustrialization. The bank in Mechanic Falls, where my grandparents lived, is boarded up along with nearly every downtown store. The paper mill closed decades ago. There's a strip club in the center of town. The jobs, at least the good ones, are gone. Many of my relatives and their neighbors work up to 70 hours a week at 3 minimum wage jobs without benefits, maybe to make $35,000 a year. Or they simply have no jobs. They cannot afford adequate health coverage under the scam of Obamacare. Alcoholism is rampant in the region. Heroin addiction is an epidemic. Labs producing the street drug methamphetamine make up a cottage industry. Suicide is common. Domestic abuse and sexual assault destroys families. Despair and rage among the population have fueled an in-cahoot racism, homophobia, Islamophobia, and feed the latent and ever-present poison of white supremacy. They also nourish the magical thinking peddled by the con artists and the Christian right, the state lotteries that fleece the poor, and the entertainment industry that night after night shows visions of an American lifestyle on television screens, like The Apprentice typified this, that fosters unattainable dreams of wealth and celebrity. Those who are cast aside as human refuge often have a psychological need for illusions and scapegoats. They desperately seek the promise of divine intervention, the unplug from a reality that is too hard to bear. They see in others, especially those who are different, the obstacles to their advancement and success. We must recognize and understand the profound despair that leads to these reactions. To understand these reactions is not to condone them. The suffering of the white underclass is real. I mentioned recently that when I was living in a tiny town, Katanning, Pennsylvania, where there were only unemployed Polish miners, it was depressing. It was bleak. The energy of the people were bleak. Yet they were forgotten. They were never on the news. But it's a reality. We have a perpetual underclass. For those of you who watched my film, Poverty Inc., you saw after 7 years of traveling America, I brought you the faces and the stories of the underclass, those who did nothing wrong to anyone, but were looked upon as some vile appendage that was no longer of use, to be cut off. Its members struggle with humiliation and a crippling loss of self-worth and dignity. The last thing they need or deserve is politically correct thought police telling them what to say and think and condemning them as mutations of human beings. Those cast aside by the neoliberal order have an economic identity that both the liberal class and the right wing are unwilling to acknowledge. This economic identity is one of the white underclass shares with many other discarded people, including the undocumented workers and the people of color demonized by the carnival barkers on cable news shows. This is an economic reality the power elites invest great energy in masking. The self-righteousness of the liberal class, which revels in imagined tolerance and enlightenment while condemning the white underclass as irredeemable, widens the divide between white low-wage workers and urban elites. Liberals have no right to pass judgment on the so-called deplorables without acknowledging their pain. They must listen to their stories, which the corporate media shut out. They must offer solutions that provide the possibility of economic stability and self-respect. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. understood the downward spiral of hating those who hate you. He said, in a real sense, all life is interrelated. And that was in his letter from a Birmingham jail. All men are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. So said Dr. King. We cannot battle racism and bigotry and hate crimes that will be stoked by the Donald Trump presidency without first battling for economic justice. This is not a gap between the tolerant and the intolerant. It is a gap between most of the American population and our oligarchic and corporate elites, which Trump epitomizes. It is a gap that is understood only in the light of the demand for economic justice. And when we start to speak in the language of justice first, and the language of inclusiveness second, we will begin to blunt the proto-fascism being embraced by many Trump supporters. My view of the tens of millions of Americans who have fallen into the embrace of the Christian right's magical thinking underwent a profound change as I conducted interviews. And yet today, look where we're at. The liberal class has no hope of defeating the rise of American fascism until it unites with the dispossessed white working class. It has no hope of being an effective force in politics until it articulates a viable socialism. Corporate capitalism cannot be regulated, reformed, or corrected. A socialist movement dedicated to demolishing the cruelty of the corporate state will do more to curb the racism of the white underclass than lessons by liberals and moral purity. Preaching multiculturalism and gender and identity politics will not save us from the rising sadism in American society. It will only fuel the anti-politics that has replaced politics. Liberals have sprinkled academic, corporate, media, and political institutions with men and women of different races and religions. This has done nothing to protect the majority of marginalized people who live in conditions that are worse than those that existed when Dr. King marched on Selma. It is boutique activism. Boutique activism. It is everywhere, especially in Pacifica. It is about branding. It is not about justice. Maria Bookchin excoriated the irrelevancy of a liberal class that busied itself with the numbing quietude of the polling booth and the deadening platitudes of petition campaigns, car bumper sloganeering, and contradictory rhetoric of manipulative politicians, the specter sports of public rallies, and finally, the knee-bent humble pleas for small reforms. In short, the mere shadows of the direct action, embattled commitment, insurgent conflicts, and social idealism that marked every reactionary, revolutionary project in history. Human history, as both Bookchin and Marx understood, is defined by class struggle. America's corporate elites successfully fused the two major political parties into a single corporate party, one that seized control of electoral politics, internal security, the judiciary, the universities, the arts, financed nearly all forms of popular communications, including Hollywood and public relations and the press. There is no way within the system to defy the demands of Wall Street, the fossil fuel industry, or war profiteers, and Trump is about to remove whatever tepid restraints are left. Our enemy is not the white working poor any more than it is an African American or undocumented worker or Muslims or Latinos or members of the GBLT community. The oligarchs and corporations, many of them proponents of political correctness, they are the enemy. If we shed our self-righteousness and hubris, if we speak to the pain and suffering of the working poor, we will unmask the toxins of bigotry and racism. We will turn the rage of an abandoned working class, no matter what its members' color, race, or religion, or creed, against those who deserve it. Back in a moment with my guest, Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. For those of you up in Woodstock, look forward to seeing you there Saturday night at 7 p.m. For those on Long Island, Huntington Arts Cinema, Sunday at noon for the premiere of my new feature film documentary, Plant Codes. Very upbeat, positive film. New York, sometime in the very near future, hopefully the next 3 weeks, we'll have a premiere here as a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI. Now let's go down to the Ozark Mountains. We're standing by is Andrew Harvey. Gave you his bio a little earlier. Nice to have you with us today, Andrew.
Absolutely, Gary. Always wonderful to be with you and wonderful to hear your ferocious analysis of what's happening. I really honor it and love it because it cuts to the quick of the transformation that has to happen now in the heart of the progressives to get real about what's been born and what's now possible. And I really honor your understanding that nothing can be done without facing the immense shadow of quietude, smugness, and passivity that has characterized the liberal approach. This is key to the shattering we need to go through to become real about what's really dangerous and how we can really meet it with the fullness of a much humbler, much more awake, and much more active self. I love what you said about boutique activism. Up to now, that's all it's been, but now is an opportunity to get real about deeply inspired sacred action, movements of profound resistance to the growing dangers that are so obviously incarnated in this election.
I appreciate that, and that credit has to go to also Chris Hedges.
We
just experienced one of the most bizarre elections in U.S. history, and perhaps in Western civilization for that matter. Trump is undoubtedly a menace, but he really is not a great surprise. Regardless of how shocked his non-supporters felt, the fact is his smug, gloating face is the face of the way things have been in Washington and Wall Street and corporate worlds for a long time. In his book on rhetoric, Aristotle writes about the individuals who he calls the prosperous fool. Here's what Aristotle said. Wealthy men are insolvent and arrogant. Their possession of wealth affects their understanding. They feel as if they have every good thing that exists. Wealth becomes a sort of standard of value for everything. They are luxurious and ostentatious. Because of the luxury in which they live and prosper that they display, their ostentatiousness is also vulgar. Because, like other people, their minds are regularly occupied with the object of their love and admiration. And because that they think that their other people's ideas of happiness is the same as their own, then Aristotle continues, rich men also consider themselves worthy to hold public office because they consider they already have the things that give a claim to the office. In a word, the type of character produced by wealth is that of a prosperous fool. And the wrongs they do spring from the insolence and self-indulgence. And that was Aristotle writing long ago.
So
clearly, Trump and so many of the oligarchs, and the Clintons as well, and Obama as well, they've been a part of every White House administration since Reagan. They all are the same to me. It is amazing how our early ancestors possessed far wiser insight into the nature of the world and people than we do today. So would you please comment on what you perceive as being the likely dangers our nation will face when a prosperous fool comes with prosperous, foolish children and millennials on top of that, and becomes commander-in-chief and surrounds himself with a legion of technocratic fools who are also prosperous and cunning? And then second, why shouldn't we be surprised that Trump is now surrounding himself with extremist politicians, extremist business personalities, we're completely out of sync with the pulse of the nation and the global civilization and the issues that we all face. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, I think what we have to face is that the monster shadow of America has been born and is now incarnated in this being and in his advisors. And this is a monster, narcissist, sociopathic shadow grounded in demented greed. And it has been incarnated politically now and has been given immense power and will play its craziest fantasies out. So I think worst case scenario, we see the birth of a new kind of fascism, which will be more dangerous than anything imagined by the old, because it will have nuclear and biological weapons at its disposal, a massive surveillance state at its disposal, a completely servile, fun-driven media at its disposal, a crumbled educational system to pump propaganda through, and all kinds of excuses to create crises that allow it to implement martial law. I think these bunch of gangsters are capable of something like that. I think that is the worst case scenario, but the second worst case scenario is appalling too, that we just live through recurring demented crises which just stagger us from one collapse to another under this bunch of maniacs who are acting out the American id on crack. So this is a very dangerous situation, and what's essential, it seems to me, is everyone to get real about how dangerous it is, and then to get real of the necessity of going far more deeply within into the recesses of your spirit to find the energy and joy and commitment that you're going to need for the long haul, and then really take seriously what it is to become someone dedicated to sacred action in such a situation on behalf of staying human and serving humanity. This, to me, is the core of the message of all the authentic teachers at this moment, and I count amongst those my friend and someone whom I revere, Chris Hedges, who has been absolutely unillusioned about the depth of what we're going through, but has really proposed also true solutions, solutions of sacred defiance, solutions of staying human. This is what's needed, and that can be only done through spiritual practice and through commitment to really turning up in sacred action, both, so that you discover a wholly new level of joy and energy available to you from a wholly new level of love in action born in you. So I see this wake-up call to this monstrous possibility as a tremendous sacred evolutionary opportunity for millions of people to get real about the true danger of this shadow, that it could annihilate the planet, and to get real about doing the inner work to sustain the joyful and passionate and compassionate outer work that must be done on a global scale to give humanity a chance of survival now.
I appreciate that. Very, very deep and meaningful to me to hear that. One of our great national essayists is Louis Lapham.
Oh, I love his work. Oh, my God, what a master he is.
And Lewis has recently defined the new era we're marching into as the age of folly, a realization that we can take home from this recent election between Trump and Clinton is that as long as people remain immersed in the idea that their beliefs and fears cannot be changed and that they are determined to not change them, then ignorance will always remain as a choice. And this election proves that more and more people are choosing ignorance as their guide instead of reason and intuition. And then there is also the question of the moral principles people are bashing around. And I consider this bashing in an ignorant space where you go into a space and you just let loose as if you were in a rage, screaming, yelling, kicking, spitting, hitting in the air. And you don't know what you're doing. You don't know why you're doing it. You just know you're so damn frustrated. And that's what I believe a lot of Americans are facing today. So can you address the underpinnings for why people resist changing in the first place, their minds or beliefs, particularly when they support that which is unquestionably in their worst interest and prefer to choose ignorance over moral truths.
Well, in a way, Gary, you're describing the human condition. You're describing liberals and Democrats as just as much as Republicans. Because I think Republicans and Democrats have been very unawake to the pain of the working poor, have been very unawake to the seething, boiling suffering that has humiliated so many millions of people. And insofar as both Democrats and Republicans of the old-fashioned kind don't really absorb how they have let their truth and heart go in not observing what's going on and not relating to it, they really don't know anything about themselves. So I would say that we've come to a crisis of love, that unless we choose to do the extraordinarily important shadow work you were talking about in the excerpt I overheard, the shadow work of truly understanding and innerstanding that Trump is within us, that we are also Trump, that the whole seething, boiling frustration is also in us, that the wild and difficult and very painful and cruel attitudes that we denounce in others are also in us, and that we have to get to a new level of consciousness which can embrace our embrace of every human being as a face of us, to start doing the real work of love in the world, because it's only from a consciousness like that that the healing actions born from joy and sacred knowledge can really work in a crisis as extreme as this. That's how I see it, and that's how I try to live it, and that's who I see many people living this, because many of us have known that this was going to come. It was going to get as extreme, as surreal, as devastating as this, and we've been preparing for this, and we know that it's possible to live this from the deepest purpose, the most profound sense of meaning, the most profound joy. It's not a dereliction. It's an incredible spiritual opportunity to get real about transforming your heart into a sacred heart and your boutique activism into a real sacred activism that really tries to do something real in a really dangerous situation.
Each morning when I finish my writings, generally the essays or the short pieces that I try to present on the program, commentaries, I go to a gym. And in that gym, I say hello to everyone, but I get on a particular machine that's a hard machine, and I'm working on it. But I can't help but hear all the conversations around me. And the conversations have always been the same, that angry people who only focus upon what money or power or both will give them, how they in turn give this to their children, so their children... It's no longer that their child is a wiser child, a more, let's say, humane-thinking child with empathy,
right,
but rather which school they're going to, how much they're paying for it, how hard they had to work to get in that tutor, that class, that award. And then when it came to Trump winning, they went absolutely ballistic. At no point did they stop for a moment and say, okay, we're good upper West Side liberal Democrats. All right? We're smart. We're well-educated. We're well-connected. And it's one of those moments where I'd like to stop. I don't, because I have to also use good manners and respect their rights.
Of course.
And so I just listen. But if I was to engage a fantasy, I would step off my VersaClimber and I would say to them, you are right to be concerned about Trump, and I'm fully understanding and appreciating your anger at him. But should we not also take a look at, could you show me what would be different today? Would you be angry today if Hillary Clinton were elected? You say that she deserved her election because she's a woman. Well, what does it mean to be a woman when you do not care about the women who died needlessly, over 20,000 in Libya, the women whose children died from sanctions in Iraq in 1992, 93, because the Clintons, over 500,000 children died. What is it to be in favor of women when you're not supporting the women's rights in Saudi Arabia? You have the power to influence it, but you choose not to because you made another choice. What does it say to us when you supported the oligarchs in Honduras and all the union-leading women were either arrested or killed? In fact, the top leading woman activist in Honduras was shot and killed.
Oh, God, yes.
And she supported that coup. So do you support the black women? You say you're supporting the blacks, and I see token blacks on the stage, but are those the same blacks that live in the black neighborhoods who suffer? And if so, if you're putting their children in jail, their husbands and their sisters, mothers in jail for marijuana, how can you support them? How can you support with you and your husband taking away their welfare rights? So tell me how the world is better. She wants to use the nuclear weapons, have the capacity. She said it's on the table for Russia and for Iran. How does that make it a safer world? She doesn't believe that Israel should be challenged, but rather given everything it wants. How does that bring peace to the Palestinian-Israeli issue? She says she's for our environment, but she supports fracking. So tell me exactly why you should not be angry or concerned if Clinton would have won, but you are with Trump. Can you show me a viable difference of what it's going to be to the average person, to our environment, to human rights, to animal rights, to world rights, if either one were elected? Where is your rage there? Could you address that, please?
Absolutely. I think what you're really discussing, and I think this is becoming clearer through my understanding of how the world is working at the moment, from everything I'm reading from the leading economists and cultural commentators, and that is that there is a war behind the scenes going on between what is called old money and what is new money. Old money is the old, corrupt, tolerant, manipulative money that has fueled the Hillary Clintons of this world. It has used them to stay in power while giving away just enough to placate the masses. New money is the Koch money, the money of the new billionaires that is absolutely nameless and ruthless and willing to do anything to control and has a master-slave mentality. And that is a much more ferocious kind of manipulation, and that's what's being born now in Trump. Trump is the incarnation of it, already flaunting the presidency as a kind of all-time amazing business opportunity for himself. This is the ultimate slap in the face of American democracy.
Doesn't he remind you in some respects of Claudius?
Yes, he's got the same kind of giggling, corrupt weirdness that Claudius had, especially in the Robert Graves book and in the early TV black and white interpretation when he was played by Charles Laughton. It was an amazing performance.
He just,
terrifying.
It's just, there's such symbolism here. Finally, I know that you hold the view, because you mentioned earlier in our discussion, that joy is the ultimate nature of reality.
Oh, yes.
And that
yes.
The absence of joy is at the root of our current social and environmental and global crisis. But then you're also referring to a particular type of joy that needs to be differentiated from the faux happiness or mere monetary pleasures, which is what the majority of people to define as joy in their lives. Anyone who's met spirituality and spiritually in evolved human beings will experience an uncanny, deep, and inner joy or happiness in them. And it's not a faux happiness that runs away or denies suffering. And if we are to believe the words of the Buddha, as long as we are in this material world of impermanence and gross emotion and feelings and thoughts that are conditioned because they are subject to the laws of cause and effect, then periods and experiences of suffering and pain are inevitable. And our moments of limited happiness and pleasure are also impermanent. We experience them and then they cease to exist. So differentiate between the authentic joy and a faux joy or happiness. And that will be our final thought today.
Oh, that is so beautiful what you said about the Buddha, and it goes to the heart of why I and Carolyn Baker have written our book, Return to Joy, because in it we're trying to offer people the way of living in real, deep, sacred joy in the middle of this extreme crisis, and serving and acting from that place. And so being fed by peace and being fed by energy and being fed by passion and being fed by compassion. And the most beautiful quotation that we have in the book about the essential nature of joy and the difference between it and happiness comes from Eckhart Tolle, whom I very much admire. And he says, things and conditions that can give you pleasure, but they cannot give you joy. Nothing can give you joy. Joy is uncaused and arises from within as the joy of being. It is an essential part of the inner state of peace, the state that has been called the peace of God. It is your natural state, not something that you need to work hard for or struggle to attain. And that is really the message of all of the truly awake mystical traditions. They all say that that is where you come to when you surrender deeply enough to the mystery and to the love that is the essence of the mystery. It brings you to a place where you live a sacred life and live in joy in whatever circumstances arise, giving everything you have and doing everything you do from that joy consciousness, because that's the ultimate form of rebellion. That's the ultimately subversive act. That's the act that seeds the golden seeds of a real human future, if there is one in this situation. And we won't know and we can't know, but what we can know is that if we live like that, we will be sowing a harvest which has an amazing chance through grace of continuing as we go through this great shattering, this great evolutionary shattering that we're about to go through, that we are going through.
But we will arise from this. Andrew, thank you for being on today. We appreciate it. Andrew's new book is called Return to Joy. His website is andrewharvey.net. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.